Good morning. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm co-director of the Africa program here at CSIS, and I want to welcome you this morning and our panelists. We've done a number, over the past couple of years, we've done a number of events on Somalia, many of which we've called on Matt for assistance with. And unfortunately, they all conclude a little bit the same. We've kind of ground into this stalemate on Somalia. And I hope today we might come forward with maybe some shred of hope for a way forward. But I guess we'll see. The most recent events, the killing of Aden Hashi Airo, we'd love to hear from Matt on kind of what he thinks the implications of that might be. I think that particular strike aside, it probably doesn't do us any good for that to be kind of the most conspicuous or visible aspect of U.S. engagement in Somalia. The calls are for much more robust, energetic, and sustained diplomatic effort that I think put some distance between us and the Ethiopians, for example, acknowledging some of the grievances of the resistance or the insurgency, however you might call it, while condemning some of the tactics. And galvanizing a much greater and more robust UN and international response. We have today with us Matt Bryden. I think many of you know, a longtime Somali expert. As I said, we've turned to him throughout the years for analysis. Was for some time with the International Crisis Group, now an independent consultant based in Nairobi. We have also with us Patrick Duplat, who's an advocate at Refugees International. Patrick has conducted a number of missions in Zimbabwe, in Central Africa, and in Somalia. He was with Médecins Frontières some time ago in Somalia for just under a year, and most recently traveled to Somalia in February and March, and has published with his colleague a report that you'll find outside on the front desk there. And if we run out of copies, it's available on the Refugees International website as well. So Patrick will be talking about the humanitarian situation, but also thoughts on the peacekeeping, kind of prospects for peacekeeping mission. Finally, we have with us Princeton Lyman, Ambassador Princeton Lyman, who I think pretty much everybody knows, former ambassador to Nigeria and South Africa. A adjunct fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, one of our great friends and analyst on African issues. Princeton was in Nairobi in late March, early April, I think, with UN Special Envoy Ould Abdallah involved in some of the opposition, talks with the opposition then. And Princeton will talk a little bit about kind of the diplomatic aspects going forward. So we'll go in that order and talk for 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, Matt, welcome, and thanks again.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be back at CSIS, not least because it's a chance to see many old friends and familiar faces around the table, whom otherwise I don't get to see for months or years at a time. And it's a pleasure to be speaking again to the topic of Somalia and its implications for regional and international security. Although I have to admit that with an introduction like that, being asked to try and find something positive to draw out and possibly some new ideas, it's a little intimidating. Almost as intimidating as the title, The Future of Somalia. When I saw that come in on the invitation in my email, I was thinking of booking an earlier flight back to Nairobi. The future of Somalia, I often say to myself that trying to predict in Somalia is a bit of a fool's game. Whatever you think is going to happen, you will be proven wrong. But with that said, I'm going to cheat a little bit and interpret this more as discussion on the futures of Somalia or the possible futures of Somalia and try to look at some of the dynamics and trends that could take us in different directions and will shape the evolution of the situation over the coming months and possibly years. And these, of course, I hope will suggest some of the policy options and some of the decisions that could be taken in various places to guide the way forward. I agree. I expect that the death of Adan Hashi Iroh is on a number of people's minds. If you follow Somalia, this has been the big news over the weekend, and it raises a number of questions about the future of Iroh's group, the Shabab, of jihadist organizations in Somalia, and of their associates in Al-Qaeda East Africa. There's been a lot of analysis. I'm amazed by the speed with which people step in to explain what this means and what will happen next. We've seen various voices saying that this will damage the peace process, support the peace process, that the Shabab now, some of them threatening to take revenge. So a lot of possible outcomes of this strike over the weekend. I would suggest that if we're going to understand an event like Iroh's death, what it means, and we have to look at actually the broader nature of jihadist movements in Somalia, where they come from and how they, and particularly the Shabab today, function. There haven't been a great many of them. There have been a handful since the beginning of the 20th century. And they have a jihadist movements over the last, in the modern era, in the post-colonial era, colonial and post-colonial, have a number of elements in common, and I'd like to throw them out, give you a kind of bigger picture of what we may be talking about. All of them, and I won't go into great detail, but the Darawish movement of Sheikh Mohammed Abdullah Hassan in the early 20th century, Al-Ittihad in the 1990s, the Shabab, both as part of the Union of Islamic Courts and now on their own. The first thing that they have in common is they piggyback on nationalism. And the more sort of globalized version of Salafi jihadism espoused by Al-Qaeda and its affiliates may overlap with nationalist or sort of these proto-nationalist jihadisms of Somalia and of other countries around the world. It's not the only place where jihadist movements have a very strong national character. But the degree to which these groups are able to garner support and legitimacy is in large part a function of nationalism. That means that their success is linked to their nationalist credentials and therefore to a certain extent to the degree to which there are rivals for clan loyalties or subnational loyalties or national loyalties. The Al-Ittihad of the 1990s, for example, had to compete with a whole range of Somali factions, including General Ideeds, which was the most prominent, fighting the U.S. and the U.N., which was able to rally support in certain parts of Somalia. There were other factions that had fought to overthrow the Barre regime, which enjoyed a certain degree of legitimacy at that time. So Al-Ittihad had a great deal of competitors and of course, wasn't particularly successful by the mid-1990s. A combination of friction with other Somali groups and then Ethiopian intervention had been largely dismantled. The Shabab, and within particularly during the period of the Islamic Courts, of course, they could claim a nationalist platform because they were fighting against the presence of Ethiopian forces on Somali soil, and the TFG, which was widely perceived as a government beholden to Ethiopian political interests or an extension of those interests. This has allowed the opposition, broadly writ, and jihadists more narrowly, to claim some a nationalist platform. Religious legitimacy is also very important. Jihadism is a fringe, sort of extremist tendency in Somalia, minority. The degree to which it resonates with the belief and practice of Islam in Somali society is a large factor in its success or failure. In the past, again, jihadism has never really resonated. It did to the degree that the Darawish represented a new reformist, puritanical version of Islam back in the early 20th century. There was a certain degree of support, but to a large extent, the Darawish drew their support from certain clans, and also their fight against the British presence in Somaliland and Ethiopian incursions into what many call the Ogaden. We could, coming up to the present day, I think you can see parallels. We can see that in the with Al-Ittihad, again, this puritanical, largely Wahhabi-influenced version of Islam didn't really take off in the early 1990s. Again, the Shabab's real moment came where within the Islamic courts in 2006, they were part of a broader coalition where you had, within the courts, you had Somali Shafi'i traditionalists, you had reformists from the Muslim Brothers, you had more conservative Salafis, Wahhabis, and you had, at the extreme fringe, the Shabab. And so they were part of an umbrella that had religious legitimacy, but on their own remained very much a fringe, at odds with and encountering friction with the rest of that coalition. Another key element, the presence of a foreign aggressor or occupier. And so, again, in the early 20th century, we had the British, we had Ethiopia, Abyssinia moving, expanding eastwards, and the Darawish were sort of proto-nationalist resistance to expanding colonialism in the Horn. In the 1990s, we had the US and UN perceived by some Somalis as a foreign aggressor or occupier, and today we have Ethiopia. I'm going to have to sort of accelerate a bit. But so in this context, what does Iroh's death mean? The Shabab basically remain an extremist group with increasing difficulties or friction with the mainstream opposition, the Alliance for the Reliberation of Somalia based in Asmara, and various other groups who are non-aligned on the ground in Somalia. Is his death going to further or retard the peace process? I think by and large this will be this removes a figure, a leader of a movement that has cast itself as a spoiler, and nothing but a spoiler. The chances of the Shabab coming into any kind of dialogue, playing a positive role in the peace process, are very low, if not zero. They've made that in clear in numerous public statements. And so I don't think that in and of itself Iroh's death is going to create any problems for the peace process. What it has done is force other groups, the Alliance, some other opposition groups, to posture, to object to what they see as an infringement of Somali sovereignty. Some would argue as an illegal action, but politically I think it's generally going to remove an obstacle and help move the process forward. The Shabab have threatened revenge. Is this likely to create a problem? I don't think so. The Shabab are under pressure to escalate their actions as it is. They have been escalating over time. They are operating probably at the limit of their capacity. They were likely to continue to try to escalate, hit higher profile targets inside Somalia, potentially at some point outside. Anyway, Iroh's death, I think, is unlikely to affect their desire to continue to escalate and to portray themselves as a key player and as a potential spoiler. But the future of the Shabab writ large, I think, it really depends on factors much larger than Iroh's death or the death of any single leader. What it's really about is the political space that they can find, whether they, whether it is as a nationalist opposition, whether it is as a religious reformist revolutionary group. It's going to have to do with the way the political process evolves in the coming months or over the next couple of years. And that leads me then to a second set of issues about the possible futures for Somalia, and that's the peace process. First of all, the peace process, it's now, the political process has advanced further than I think many had believed or hoped that it might. And we are apparently on the verge of the first formal contacts between the Asmara-based opposition and the TFG. This is often described as the Prime Minister's initiative. It's the Prime Minister's peace process. It's the Prime Minister's... I think that's really... while the Prime Minister deserves a great deal of credit for it, it really does understate or undersell the dialogue. This process has a number of stakeholders. The Prime Minister is one who's taken the initiative and pushed it with the formal endorsement of the TFG, but he's just one of several. The Alliance for the Reliberation of Somalia has also come out with its set of counter-proposals in a kind of informal roadmap that has been fairly widely circulated, which is complementary and meshes very closely with this, the proposals that the Prime Minister has put on the table. And we have the UN, which has, over the last year or so and under new leadership on the ground, moved forward as a to really shepherd international engagement on Somalia. The new SRSG, Ambassador Old Abdullah, taking the lead there. So we have a number of stakeholders firmly behind the process. We have some who are less firmly behind or are overtly opposed. While we have the commitment of the TFG as a whole, there are certainly elements of the TFG who have either privately or publicly made it clear that they're not comfortable with the Prime Minister's initiative. They think this is the time for a security-based approach that's too early for talks, and so there's some foot-dragging on whether or not dialogue should go forward and what should be on the table. And this is likely to hinge particularly, although superficially, on who's in and who's out. Who do we talk to? Are they terrorists or are they legitimate opposition? On the other side, we have the Shabab and we have hardliners within the alliance in Asmara who have made their discomfort clear. And there's been a lot of pressure on Sheikh Sharif and Sharif Hassan not to go to Djibouti for these talks, to explain themselves. And so we have a general picture in which we have, in fact, two alliances committed to this process, the TFG as an alliance or coalition and the ARS as a kind of alliance or coalition, both unwieldy, both heterogeneous, and struggling to come together for some kind of dialogue. And I'll come back to that, because that's going to be a critical element in how the talks may evolve. We have Ethiopia and Eritrea, both backing their respective clients or proxies, both of them with ambiguous approaches. Both, in a sense, committed, allowing space for dialogue to go forward, but at the same time, Ethiopia maintaining some freedom of action in terms of security, military action on the ground, a plan to deploy up to 20,000 new police officers trained in Ethiopia, which has not been closely coordinated with the TFG leadership. Some confusion about what direction, what that really means, what signals we're seeing from Addis. And Asmara as well, which also seems to be now trying to impose itself a little more on the actions of the alliance. And then there's a whole range of other groups. This is not about two neat alliances, government and opposition, getting together and stitching up a deal. There are other constituencies, some of them characterized more by a clan, others independent political groups, that are neither part of the alliance nor part of the TFG. We have the Hawiya Leadership Committee, which has been talking now to both, met with the Prime Minister, has met with the opposition. Where do they stand? Where do they fit? If we come to the table, where do these independent groups sit, or do they not sit? Do we risk a kind of CPA, Sudanese CPA situation, where we have two parties at the table and many others who then feel that they need to fight their way in, demonstrate their importance by picking up arms? So some questions there about how that's managed. And I think the key here, just to foreshadow it, is that particularly the TFG and the alliance at this early stage are pressured to remain together. So possible futures. One is that this dialogue does go forward, but then peters out, as the Khartoum talks did between the ICU and the government in 2006, precisely because, the cohesion of either side breaks down. One part, you know, the Prime Minister goes forward, the President puts on the brakes. We might see Prime Minister resign or be dismissed. There was a motion being discussed to have him hold before Parliament to account not long ago. We could see the alliance break apart in Asmara. We could see simply that they agree to disagree or fail to find common ground. What would then happen? Well, time's too short for another round of peace talks. Then we may well see the TFG, or at least part of it, try to unilaterally prolong its own mandate and say, well, we've run out of time. We're going to stay in power for another 3 or 5 years. and it's not our fault after all. There are all these opposition groups who've hamstrung us. What would happen then? I expect we would see radicalization, the opposition then saying, well, there's nothing left to talk about. This was always predictable. In the TFG, of course, this would already be a hardline position, a retreat from dialogue and an entrenchment for the foreseeable future. I think we would see a great deal of cynicism on the international community. Well, it's Somalia. It can't be fixed, so let's leave Somalia back again in this sort of international limbo, maybe with the occasional airstrike or military incursion across the border to deal with the bad guys, and sort of return to the status quo ante. Another option, some kind of superficial agreement. Let's say the two sides do come together in Djibouti, strike some kind of deal, but it's elite pacting, it's power sharing. It's the same kind of deal we've seen, depending on your count, 5, 6, 14 times in the past. So the alliance joins the government. Some of the government give, you know, cede their places to the alliance. We have a government of national unity, and it fails to move. Because you'll have a factionalized alliance with very different interests or a government. Is it really committed to the transition? What we've seen of transitional governments in the past is that once people are ministers and presidents and prime ministers, they're actually quite comfortable. They don't particularly want to move forward with the transitional agenda, and we get stuck. So a superficial agreement that doesn't really advance a transition is another risk. Doesn't have to be that way, but it's a possibility. The third option, then, some kind of transitional agreement that has real legs, has real substance. So the two sides come together and they agree, probably not just on the formation of a new government with some sharing of seats and positions, but actually on how the transitional process is going to go forward and be concluded. On the composition of the national commissions, on the constitution, on elections, on security that are going to carry the transition forward. And really then the job of the political deal is to create the political and security environment within which these commissions function. And the commissions themselves are independent, shared institutions. The opposition have nominated some members. The government nominates some members. And these really do get on with their work. That's going to be tricky. We've already seen a constitutional commission named in the past by the TFG. It's not a shared commission, nor is the Reconciliation Commission a shared commission with the opposition. So could these be renegotiated, and could the timetable be renegotiated? Because even if we have a deal now, we've certainly not got the time for the transition to be to run its course by 2009. But I think there is a real difference between an extension of the process, where all the parties agree to extend to give themselves time to go forward, and one in which basically peace dialogue has failed, and one party says, well, we're going to stick around. We're going to remain where we are. Where this takes us in terms of the bigger picture, and I'll sort of conclude with this, some remarks about the transition writ large. The 2009 deadline is unrealistic. That's to believe that we might be able to organize some kind of viable constitutional dialogue that is representative and has credibility. To draft an acceptable constitution, to devise from scratch, because really nothing has been done so far, very little has been done, a political system, legislative framework for a multi-party system, to look at the sort of balloting and electoral system, the constituencies, electoral constituencies, the electoral laws. All of this just is waiting to be done, and we have less than a year and a half left to do it in. All of those issues depend on much bigger and thornier issues that already have been put forward within the transitional process. What is the structure of the Somali state going to be? Some of you have heard me say this before, but I'll come back to it because it's not on the table. Federalism is not yet the agreed model for Somalia, and there's very little, even if it were, Somalia were to move in a federal direction, what does that really mean? What degree of autonomy and decentralization are we talking about? These are not theoretical. They have to do with how much money the Port of Bosaso will remit to a central government or the Port of Kismayo. They will have to do with the rights of citizens. does federalism mean that if you're a citizen of, put a citizen of Puntland before you're a citizen of Somalia or a citizen of central Somalia? Where can you vote? Where can you stand for office? And so on. And there, and where can you own land? Because land is one of the big subtexts in the Civil War. You know, who has expanded and occupied whose land? Do they have to give it up? How is that going to be resolved? The issue of security during the transition is a big one, and I'm not going to speak to it. I understand Patrick will touch on it. But is this going to be agreed principally? Is this going to be a security going to be a function of now agreed national security sector or a peace support operation? What type of peace support operation? And will it be? Will it intervene with a mandate that's principally devised by the UN, its member states, or one that is shaped within a peace agreement that says the parties want a force of this size, this composition, this mandate, or some kind of compromise between the two? And lastly, the resources. I mean, if we're really serious about all of this happening by 2009, one of the reasons I'd suggest the international community is not is that when you put all of these elements together, the dialogue to establish the structure of the state, the constitution, the elections, and so on, we know what this takes. We've seen this in Cambodia and Namibia. We've seen in Somaliland what it takes to organize elections. And international donors are very much involved in supporting the elections in Somaliland. We know that in a territory that size, with that kind of population, it takes 12,000 people, roughly 12 months, when they've already done it three times, to organize elections. So if you just extrapolate, look at the territory and population of Somalia and the scale of the exercise, training and deploying 30, 40, 50,000 people around national elections is a huge exercise, and we haven't started yet. So what kind of international resources, how many millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars will this take? Where are they? Who's going to commit them? If a peace support operation is involved, multiply that figure. And how much time and what kind of international human resources would have to be deployed for this transition to actually unfold? Let me conclude. That's basically what it's all about, whether Iroh or another Shabab leader is killed this week or next, whether the talks go ahead, and how they go ahead. What it's really kind of going to come down to are these big issues. If we're not going to follow the same old cycle we've had for the last 17 years, if we really want to end statelessness in Somalia, curb the threat to regional and international security that it represents, combat extremism and the potential for al-Qaeda in the region, then we're going to have to come to these very complicated state-building issues. The sooner the better, and through the most representative and genuine political process possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Excellent. Patrick, you can go ahead.
I'm afraid I'm not going to be much more positive than Matt was in speaking about the humanitarian situation. I used to be an aid worker in Somalia, and I had just come back from month-long mission to Kenya and Somalia in and around Mogadishu. And I'd like to suggest that the humanitarian situation should not be understood in a vacuum, but as a situation that very much affects the politics of Somalia, not just because it's a moral issue to solve, but certainly because it has a clear influence on the political process. Just one example, Matt touched upon the popularity of the Shabab, and I don't think they're a popular group. They derive their popularity insofar as they represent an opposition to the Ethiopian troops. And so the humanitarian situation, the desperation of the people very much plays into that and has an effect on these negotiations. And it has an effect as well on the future development of Somalia. Issues of land, issues of returns of displaced people, need to be taken into account given the gravity of the situation. I think we could have had an expose on the humanitarian situation in Somalia any time in the past two decades almost and talk about how grave the situation is. However, the situation by accounts of most observers is at its worst. It has been. There's little value in trying to benchmark humanitarian crises, but several UN officials have talked about Somalia, saying it's the worst humanitarian crisis in Africa and possibly the world, and have readily talked and compared it to Darfur to try to garner as much attention as they could. Inside the country right now, you have about a million people who are displaced from their homes and about 2 million people in need of assistance. The displaced go mostly from South Central to other areas of South Central Somalia, areas of clanic origin, in urban areas as much as they can, settling with families and relatives, or in peri-urban areas where they settle in informal camps. They also go to the north of the country, Puntland, Somaliland, and also outside the country, to Yemen, Ethiopia, and Kenya. In Yemen, you have 100,000 registered refugees, and the government of Yemen estimates that there are about 250,000 Somalis who have crossed the Gulf of Aden. 30,000 of them crossed in 2007. 1,500 died in the crossing, just leaving from Bosaso to the coast of Yemen. You have about 200,000 refugees in Kenya, and some of those are long-standing refugees, but right after the Ethiopian army came into Somalia in December 2006, there was a wave of 40,000 crossing that border, and that border is now closed. And you have about 45,000 refugees in Ethiopia. And again, this suggests that the situation needs to be understood and will have an impact for long-term development issues. Mogadishu has always been a place of mixed clan presence. The clan makeup of Mogadishu has been varied, but there are suggestions that returns could be further complicated by different groups claiming areas, new areas and old areas for their own clan. Whenever we talk about a humanitarian situation, we need to talk about the response. And what is most striking in Somalia is the growing gap between the level of need and the level of response. NGOs operate based on the constraints they face and not by the needs of the beneficiaries. Ideally, any NGO would provide a service based on the needs of a certain population in a certain area. And in the case of Somalia, especially today, they operate based on security constraints and how much access they can have. In South Central Somalia, so excluding Somaliland, which is fairly stable, and Puntland, which was a relatively stable area until fairly recently, you have fewer than 150 expatriate staff, which is an extremely low number when compared to the level of need. And as I mentioned, the worst, possibly the worst humanitarian crisis in Africa. Aid workers have been targeted. The death of two MSF workers has been much publicized. There have been kidnappings in Puntland in the south recently. An FAO, two FAO workers were kidnapped. And the targeting of aid workers has various different reasons. It might be a very local reason, financial short-term gain, or it has more politically minded motives. Usually, in most areas, NGOs represent the largest employer in a particular region. And so by kidnapping, threatening, or killing aid workers, NGOs withdraw, and with it, the services to a certain population and the money of employment that goes to the Somalis. Most of the displaced that we talk to, especially in and around Mogadishu, and just around Mogadishu, you have 200 to 250,000 people who have fled the city in the largest displaced camp in the world. And most of the displaced that we talk to point the finger at Ethiopian forces and TFG forces. Numerous stories of assassinations, rapes, shelling of neighborhoods, houses being destroyed, loss of relatives, loss of income. whenever operations are conducted in the background market, there are several consequences. It's not only on the direct threat to a person and to death of civilians in crossfire, it's also loss of livelihood as being the main market in town. These 200 to 250,000 people are entirely dependent on foreign aid for food, shelter, water, and as I mentioned, aid is not forthcoming because of security impediments. By blaming the Ethiopians is not to say that abuses are not committed on all sides. There are documented abuses by militias, including al-Shabaab, but it's particularly damning that it comes from the TFG forces and the Ethiopian military, and that these abuses go on unchecked. And it has, as I mentioned earlier, consequences on the political process, because people see the TFG as lacking legitimacy, because it doesn't provide services, including protection to its people, which is the first responsibility of a government. So certainly the TFG lacks national acceptance, and may go further than that and say that the TFG is seen as the culprit by many Somalis, especially the displaced. One metaphor which was given to us, which I thought was particularly relevant, was comparing the TFG to a hologram, where it has all the trappings of formal government, but none of the services and none of the formal, none of the concrete services it should afford its citizens. So going forwards, I think the next question, when painting in such a bleak picture of the humanitarian situation, is what can NGOs do and what can the international community do? And Matt has talked about several different scenarios. What is clear is that the feelings from most NGOs is that security is the number one priority, access. Until they can have access, the humanitarian situation will continue to worsen. And access is obviously derived from a modicum of peace. However, it is our feeling that this peace cannot be enforced, and that there is little value about discussing of the arrival of an international force if it is to replace the Ethiopian troops. They would clearly be seen as a party to the conflict, and it is likely that they would face the same kind of opposition that Ethiopian troops currently face. There's a lot of hope being placed into the negotiations, as Matt mentioned, but it's unlikely that any settlement on paper will translate into a ceasefire on the ground. And so what the NGO community would like to see is a step-by-step approach, obviously, and it's unlikely that there would be a top-down approach that would impose security. And the first priority in a step-by-step approach is to stop the cycle of violence and hold perpetrators to account. And there has been a strong push by many in the NGO community to have the UN get more involved in monitoring human rights abuses, to having governments involved in discussions with the TFG and Ethiopian troops to hold perpetrators to account. I think the UN Security Council is more actively seized of the matter than it has been for years. Looking at the Security Council resolutions over the past 20 years is a good indicator of international community's interest. I think there were no resolutions between 1995 and 2001, none. And there have already been two this year, with two others coming should come through in the next couple of weeks, hopefully. But I'll leave probably Princeton to talk a little bit more about these steps going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. thanks, Jennifer, and everyone for being here today. What I'd like to do is pick up and talk about the international aspects of any kind of a peace process, looking at Matt Biden's third scenario, what would actually bring peace to Somalia and some kind of stability. And I think the problem, put it in a nutshell, that I see on the international side and the support that the international community would need to give to that is that there is no common set of interests among the various international actors. If there ever was a case of trying to herd cats, this is one of them, and maybe better described as trying to herd some wild dogs together. So let me just run down quickly the various international actors and who has a stake or a real stake and a real interest in a stable, secure, unified Somalia. Well, you look at Ethiopia, which has a big stake now bogged down into an insurgency. But Ethiopia really basically is not concerned about a strong Somalia, has never wanted a strong Somalia government, happy to have a weak Somalia, even an anarchic Somalia, as long as it doesn't have a government that threatens Ethiopia. Obviously, they'd like to be out of there, but they're not going to support a peace process that may bring even indirectly into power people they think are opposed to Ethiopia. And, of course, the Ethiopian troop issue is at the center of much of the negotiations. Let's talk about the United States. The United States policy is on the surface to support the TFG, bring in the African peacekeeping operation to substitute for the Ethiopians, a policy that isn't really going anywhere, spent $50 million to bring in the Ugandans and Burundis, but the rest of the Africans aren't going to come in. And the U.S. gives lip service support to the role of Amadou and trying to support the SRSG and the UN peace effort. But really, there are elements of the U.S. government that are happy if it's a situation in which we can bomb freely because there's no real government or anybody to ask permission and to go after terrorists. So the degree of U.S. total energy and commitment to solving the Somalia problem is perhaps limited. Eritrea, major player, opposition based in Asmara. Eritrea probably happier to keep the Ethiopians bogged down in Somalia than see a peace effort in which the Ethiopians can go home and be relieved of that situation. What about the Somali business community? Old Abdallah has reached out tremendously to the Somali business community to see if they can lend their weight to a peace process. Yes, they can, but by and large, they're hedging their bets. They're making money. There's $1 billion in remittances that come into Somalia every year. There's a lot of commerce going on back and forth. They don't pay any taxes. And by and large, they hedge their bets, and they don't have very much confidence in the TFG anyway. You have Qatar. What is Qatar doing out there supporting the extremists? Nobody particularly knows why, but they're doing it, or elements of Qatar are doing it. So you're not getting out of the Middle East a strong interest in bringing a peace process to fruition. Patrick talks about the UN Security Council and the UN in general. I'm more skeptical. I think the UN goes through the motions. Yes, Mr. Old Abdallah, we really should do more. Please go out there and do your best. We'll send out a mission here and there, but please, God, don't really expect us to bring in a UN peacekeeping force in Somalia because it's a mess and it's an insurgency, and we probably couldn't get people to come there anyway. So Old Abdallah is almost a lone ranger. He's out there. He's got nominally the UN behind him, but it's not very strong. Even from DPA, you don't get the fact that they think this is big and we've got to back him all the way up. What about the European Union? Yes, some people, France, UK, have a stake in this. Italy has a stake, but Italy seems to have its own foreign policy in Somalia, and it's very hard to know what they're doing. What about Sudan? Some interest, yes, but it's far away and they've got other priorities. What about Kenya? Kenya, it seems to me, is the one country that has the biggest stake in seeing a Somalia that is reasonably unified, secure, stable, and not sending lots of refugees and other people into Kenya. But Kenya is now so concerned with its own internal politics that its ability to play that leadership role is qualified. What about the Saudis? Saudis give support to the peace process. They're supposed to be hosting the second meeting of this negotiation. But again, you don't get the impression that Saudis have made this a big priority and that they can bring together these different elements and pull the support out from under Shabaab, et cetera. And what about the African Union? The African Union got itself caught up in supporting the Ethiopian invasion by and large. endorsing it, backing it, promising an 8,000-person peacekeeping force that they cannot deliver, and therefore not in a position also to be a leader in a peace process because they're too tied in the minds of many people to one side, and the relationships between AU and Eritrea are so bad that even can't get the Africans together around the AU. Now, where does this leave us? What happens here when you have a guy like Ould Abdallah, who is dedicated, trying very hard? Everybody says, thank God, sir, take the lead. This Norwegian-led contact group is phasing out, and rightfully so, because it was totally ineffective, and support. Well, this peace process can't work unless these different international elements begin to feel that they have a stake in finding a solution to the Somalia problem. And we don't have that yet. And I think the U.S. is key in this regard. I think the U.S. is not yet committed to this process, which means a number of things. It means giving up on the 8,000 AMIS force. That's not going to happen. It means accepting a broader-based government in Mogadishu than perhaps the U.S. is totally comfortable with. There may be some people in there they really don't like. And it means getting the UN, supporting the UN to give much more support, political and otherwise, to the SRSG and to the process in general. And it means using whatever influence we have in the Middle East to get more support for bringing together the various elements, and for the Middle East to use some of its economic leverage. Where does Somalia send all its exports? It sends it to the Middle East. And there's a whole question there about where the money's coming from, where is it going, who's supporting whom, and where are the Middle East countries playing in this regard? I think the Africa Union has to rethink its whole approach in Somalia. I think it has to accept the fact that the present policy is not working, that it has to say to the Ethiopians, we've got to find a different direction. We can't keep supporting this effort. We've got to find a different kind of solution, and we'd like to get you out of there as soon as possible, but we're not going to deliver the 8,000, and we've got to support a broader peace process in order to bring this under control. The TFG has to inspire. Here you get into the chicken-egg problem. If the TFG doesn't inspire, then very few people are willing to commit to it, including the Somali business community, including the ARLS. The ARLS, it's, you know, Matt knows more about this than I do, but my impression of the ARLS is, yes, we'll talk peace, but maybe the TFG will collapse anyway. So if we hold out and wait long enough, we'll have a different option. I may be wrong there, but I pick up some of that. So the TFG has to inspire, and it hasn't yet inspired. Patrick has talked about that. So it has to have stronger leadership. It has to have more unity behind the prime minister. My God, when he went to Nairobi and there was talk of him having talks in Nairobi with the opposition, there was a movement to impeach him in the TFG. That didn't inspire people to think that the TFG was really united around this. And the Ethiopian troop issue is going to be critical in any negotiations. And there you get this chicken-egg thing. How do you get security, as Patrick has talked about, but at the same time get around the problem of the Ethiopian presence, which is such a driving force in the opposition and the feeling? And it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy at all. For the ARLS, it means to separate themselves sharply and completely and much more completely from Shabaab. That's going to be tough for them to do. But unless they do that, and you get the kind of broad coalition building that Matt has talked about, you're not going to get a security situation in which outsiders feel they can come in and be supporting a broad national government against one group of extremists rather than walking into the middle of a civil war in which you've got nationalists fighting other nationalists, et cetera. You'll never get outsiders in on that kind of a situation. So I don't mean to make this a downer. But I'm not optimistic under the present structures. And if people are serious, and if they're serious about giving the UN support, because Ould Abdallah is probably the only one who has any credibility on the outside right now in the UN. UN itself is tarnished. because you, in the eyes of some of the opposition, because the UN has endorsed the TFG, they recognize the TFG, and tacitly have supported the Ethiopian incursion. If you hear Uld Abdallah when he comes here, the diaspora jumps all over him for the UN not condemning the Ethiopians. So the UN itself has a trouble, but has more credibility than others. But unless all these actors get together and say, you know, we're really serious. We're really serious. So when you call this peace meeting in Djibouti, et cetera, we're going to use all our diplomatic efforts and all our leverage to get those parties to sit down and do something. Without that, he's really a lone ranger. He's out there trying to do the impossible. I think it can be done. I hope the Kenyans will get through their internal problems and start to lead. Other African countries lead, maybe new leadership now in the AU, saying, well, wait a minute, where we're going now is terrible, and begin to bring together people around this peace process. Otherwise, I'm afraid we're going to end up with the first or second scenario that, that Matt has talked about. Thanks.
Devin O'Shaughnessy from National Democratic Institute. Three questions, but they're quick, so hopefully it won't be too much. First one is for Matt. How likely would a peace agreement hold between the TFG and the ARLS with the spoilers that you were talking about, these possible outside groups, including the Huiye Leadership Committee, and how best to include them if it's necessary to do so? Second question would be, do you believe a deal between Ethiopia and Eritrea is necessary in order to reach a long-term peace in Somalia? And third one is, with a new administration coming in, do we expect any sorts of changes to Somalia policy, any of the three administrations, or sort of status quo continue on for at least a year while they're getting their footing? Thanks.
My name is Deirdre LePin. I'm an independent consultant, and between 1987 and 1990, I was the UNICEF planning officer in Somalia and was there when the war first started, the bombing of Hargeisa and so on. Two issues weren't raised by anyone on the panel, and I just wondered if anyone wanted to address them. One is the longstanding discovery of oil deposits in Puntland in the Magertane area. By Conoco originally, and the second is the unrest, you might say, in the Ogaden, which continues.
We'll come to you in a moment. My name is Abdulkadir Abdurrahman. I represent Somali Ghost, an umbrella organization here in Washington. And I appreciate all the comments that I've heard so far. It doesn't seem there is a good news coming from all directions. But in the diaspora here, we're hopeful. One issue that people are really missing is the issue that Mr. Lehman talked about. That's the Ethiopian occupation. Ethiopian factor is one thing that who, no matter who you talk to, see as an obstacle to bring peace in Somalia. And the opposition, they have said that so many times. And before, like, the discussion of the two groups supposed to take place the 10th of this May, and a week or 2 weeks ago, the Ethiopians went to a mosque in Mogadishu and basically slaughtered people, and they were all over the news. It's not something I'm saying. You can Google it. It's on BBC News and everywhere. They are an obstacle to peace. And they know that whenever the two groups get together, discussion will focus on the withdrawal of Ethiopian forces. The second point that none of you addressed, and I would like you to address, is the International Criminal Court. How come Somalia does not have a criminal court similar to Sierra Leone, Liberia? Because that's very effective. We have a bunch of warlords that are part of the government. Some of them attacked our troops. I was one of the people who served in Somalia during 1993. one of the gentlemen who is the chief of police now running in Mogadishu, Mr. Abdelkader Eid, is the one who was supporting at the time General Eid and dragged U.S. soldiers on the ground. And instead of him facing prosecution, now we have him running the Somali police force. So the Somali population need protection. How can we protect civilians who are being occupied and being tortured by the Ethiopians and the TFG?
Hi, my name is Abdiya Mohammed, and I'm a Somali U.S. citizen. First of all, I'm very happy to see all of these people came here to listen a subject on Somalia. And I really don't know what brought everybody here, whether for information or for other businesses. But really, the reason I'm asking, I want to speak is to ask you, all of you, a very simple question. I'm very naive. Would you like to help the Somali people, including the representative of the Ethiopian embassy here? I want all of you to think a whole country destroyed. And I'm not blaming the world. I'm blaming the Somali people, particularly the Somali men who destroyed the country, who started this, who opened the door for the Ethiopian army. So everybody, when you live here, including the Ethiopians and Eritreans, please think about a whole country, a mother sitting under the shade of a tree that did not even get rain for a long time, having babies there, no medicine, no food, nothing. The world ignored Somalia. It's very, very sad. We really feel, as Somalis, we feel the world don't like us anymore. And I'm afraid we're going to be the Palestinians forever. So I'm very sorry, but please, I ask you, when you live here, think about 8 million. I had a discussion with the Ethiopian representative here before this, the session started, and he started saying, what's your clan? I said, I'm Somali, but also I'm from East Africa. I'm a human being. We have to see that. We have to see things that way. I wrote an article before the war started discussing how the Somalis were grateful to Ethiopians. When the civil war started, they welcomed. We will never forget that. But what happened and what's happening here, it's something that Somalis will never forget.
Well, let me just follow up on what a new administration might or might want to do. You know, like any situation in which you get involved like this one, it's easier to get in than get out. And I don't think that there is any short-term solutions on the table. There are processes which lead to long-term solutions. But I do think a new administration will have to look at the Horn in general and our whole relationships there. That does include the Ethiopia-Eritrea conflict because it does impact on Somalia and impacts on a lot of other things. It's not an easy one to deal with. It's very hard to deal with. But that leads me to, I think, what is one of the most critical factors in the Horn, and that is the evolution of political development in Ethiopia. What happens there impacts on the Ogaden, impacts on its relationships with Eritrea, impacts on its relationships in Somalia. And that's going to be a process that's going to take some time, but on which I would hope a new administration spends some effort and time with the Ethiopians, because I agree that if the Ethiopians had a better political process to deal with problems of the Ogaden, et cetera, the Eritrean or other involvement from outside wouldn't have as much influence as it would do. I think a second element of it is to try and shape a new consensus on Somalia policy, particularly by the African states that surround through IGAD or some other structure, and move the AU away from its current situation to where it's supporting fully this broader peace process. Third, engaging the Middle Eastern countries much more effectively on this. It's something I think we haven't done, and we're bureaucratically divided. We have an Africa Bureau, we have a Middle East Bureau, and we don't pull them together very effectively. I think also we have to figure out in our policy how we balance a very legitimate concern over terrorism with the interests of peace and stability in Somalia. I mean, it's nice to have a free fire zone in Somalia, but it's not a good long-term policy. And how do we bring that terrorism concern together? I think you can do that. You strengthen elements. You strengthen regional security elements. But we haven't done that either. So I think a new administration has to look hard at the horn and come up with new and, I think, longer-term efforts to do that. Let me make a quick comment on the ICC that was raised. Uld Abdallah has raised that with the UN, the idea of introducing the International Criminal Court. It's a little tricky when you introduce that in the middle of a conflict rather than having a truth and reconciliation and court process at the end like Sierra Leone did. It may be an incentive to have the ICC start to investigate, may scare a few people and get them to the table. I think it has to be handled with a good deal of delicacy, but it's not a bad thing to have the ICC start to look. As far as oil is concerned, it can only make the problem worse.
I just want to make a quick comment as well on the U.S. administration. I think they may be a possible slight shift in policy if the rumors of resignation of Jendai Fraser turn out to be true. I think this is somebody who has a great deal of influence on the policies on the Horn. On the ICC, as Princeton mentioned, there is interest. I think there's a procedural barrier, which is that the TFG, to my understanding, is not signatory yet. And then there's the motivational factor, the can of worms that is the ICC that is opened. But a lot of human rights monitoring alternatives exist, including the strengthening of UNPOS, the political office of the UN. Human Rights Watch has proposed a commission of inquiry along the lines that we've seen in other countries in Africa. There's the possibility of the OHCHR getting involved. So there's a wide range of tools for human rights activists and for governments to use, and ICC is not the only one. And probably the ICC is longer-term proposition as opposed to shorter-term measures that can be quickly implemented.
I'm sorry. My name is Danny. This is a question for Mr. Bryden. At the macro kind of ground-up approach question, the Bakara Market Police Force, is it succeeding? Is it not succeeding? And if it is succeeding, what implications does this have, like a lessons learned that we could maybe apply at a on a larger scale, if that is at all possible?
Okay, thank you very much. My comments are on the Ethiopian involvement. You know, my name is Asafa Dalil. I'm from the Embassy of Ethiopia. And it's good to hear some constructive ideas about our region. You know, we have a very big stake in Somalia because, as you see, Ethiopia has almost 2,000 kilometer border with Somalia. And given the situation in Somalia, our security is always threatened what is happening in Somalia. But as we made it every time clear that we are not there for to stay in Somalia. I mean, we want to withdraw, and we are withdrawing if you know, there is an international force or an EU force that can replace Ethiopian forces, not to create a vacuum in Somalia. My sister from Somalia mentioned, I think we talked about the dynamics of clan politics in Somalia. You know, there is no a national force that can claim to represent the whole of Somalia. We talked about that. I didn't ask her clanship, but you know, that is what's making very difficult to form any kind of centrally legitimate or acceptable government in Somalia. I mean, everybody has some legitimacy in Somalia. The TFG has some legitimacy, and other groups also have some legitimacy. But at least the TFG was created by an international process. It's an internationally recognized government. And, you know, we had tried 17 or 18 processes in Somalia, and you know, every time we start again, I mean, it won't be different. I mean, what we are saying is we have to support the TFG and form a broader government in Somalia, inclusive government, including all those who are outside from the process. So, you know, we are for that. Ethiopia is supporting an inclusive process, but what we need is support from the international community and others who are interested in Somalia. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm Mahmoud Noor, originally from Somalia, still a Somali. I would like to tell you that there are three levels of loyalty in Somalia. One is clan, the other is national, and the third is Islam. And we always move from this, from one level to the other, even sometimes go to sub-clans and so on and so forth. And therefore, unless we move from the clan level and go to national and religious level, because both of these have mechanism of conflict resolution. One is called Her, which is the traditional way, which is also based on Islam. And one is Islam based on the Quran and the sayings and the actions of the Prophet. Therefore, I think my suggestion is that neutral Islamic institutions like the Organization of Islamic Conference could select prominent Islamic scholars from neutral countries. And I also agree with Brisson that the Middle East and the Islamic countries should be involved more. Because why I'm saying, there was a traditional sultan in the old days in Somalia who was oppressive. On his deathbed, he said, I have tried everything with the Somalis and I have not found anything better or brother. That's the only way you can reconcile. The other thing is, if you tell a Somali, fear Allah, fear your Lord, he will react positively. Therefore, I think let's move to Islamic conference with neutral, internationally known Islamic scholars using the Quran and Sunnah to reconcile Somalia. It's one very short chapter in Quran, my Somalis would know, Surah Hujarat. If they use that, they can solve this problem very quickly. Thank you very much.
Patricia Fagan, Georgetown University. Really, in relation to the last two speakers, especially the gentleman from the Somali American Peace Organization, in looking at the actors, in talking about the actors in the peace process, what is anyone analyzing the role of the Somali diaspora, which is certainly a powerful instrument all over the world? And Princeton Lyman mentioned the business community as one of the actors, or is an actor, but and there you have, I believe, a group of people who are both inside Somalia, outside of Somalia, at different times for different purposes. I just wonder if anyone can talk to that particular group of individuals.
Okay, well, I'll try and respond to some of those questions briefly. First, on Bakaraha Market, I think that's a fascinating example. It's a sort of microcosm of what's probably needed larger scale for security in Somalia. That is, the various stakeholders have been involved, the TFG, the local business community, the key figures there, Ethiopia, have come together and agreed that this is a workable solution. There is a fairly detailed agreement on how that works, and it is linked to formal structures. Criminals caught by the private security in Bakaraha are supposed to hand them over to the Somali police because there is no judiciary. There isn't a judiciary outside Bakaraha Market either, but it's to be devoutly hoped for. But basically, I think this is the kind of security agreement that we've seen writ large work in Somaliland at some point in Puntland, where you have the stakeholders come together and work out, as an interim measure, how they want to provide security locally. It's not a permanent solution. I think private militias of this nature over the long term need to be avoided, but as a stepping stone, an excellent example of what's possible. The diaspora, just to touch on it quickly, I consider the Somali diaspora to be a bit of a misnomer. Somalia just has overflowed its borders. And if you look at the TFG is largely diaspora. The TNG before it was largely diaspora. I don't know how many of the Parliament of Foreign Passport holders. I think the diaspora, those outside, are critical precisely because there are so few barriers between those outside and inside. Everyone's on a cell phone, internet, or traveling backwards and forwards. I won't say more, but I think point well taken. The Ethiopian representative statements. Another misnomer, replacing Ethiopian forces. I think we understand what we're talking about, but I don't think Ethiopian forces can be or will be replaced in Somalia. If replacement means that you're going to have a large force involved in counterinsurgency on the ground, no one else wants to take that role. And the ENDF is an instrument of Ethiopian foreign policy, and no other force is going to intervene as an instrument of Ethiopian foreign policy. It's going to intervene as an instrument of some kind of multilateral agreement. So if we mean a different force, yes, but it'll be a different force with a different mandate. And that is, of course, a much more complicated proposition. What is that mandate going to be? Who decides what the mandate is and in what context? I think that's been touched on. But I think for Ethiopia that raises interesting questions because how will the Ethiopian government feel about a mandate that obviously comes from, is informed by a different political logic, a different type of intervention, and may involve, as Princeton said, actors whom the Ethiopian government, the U.S. government, many others, Kenyans as well, may not be comfortable with. It's not going to be easy to draw a line between those in the opposition who have legitimate grievances, who need to be involved in an agreement, and those who really are spoilers, either from the inside or from the outside. I think we have seen some positive developments in this respect. The Alliance for the Reliberation of Somalia, which until a couple of months ago was basically being treated as a pariah group based in Asmara, out of the political picture, irredeemable, is now a partner in the process. I think it's a step forward. We have a process. Let's see how they and the TFG play their cards. My view would be that we need to define the extremists or those who don't really have a legitimate stake as narrowly as possible in terms of some individuals who have a track record, in terms of those who exclude themselves by not taking part, remaining outside, remaining violent. But rather than try to draw a box around them first, let's see who comes to the table and how constructive they're prepared to be, what kind of agreement emerges, and what sort of security dispensation is therefore required. Thank you.
I'll try to be as brief as possible. On the food crisis issue, quite clearly it affects Somalia and it affects the World Food Program's ability to deliver food in sufficient quantities. But that's only one of the impediments to food delivery. The other is just the sheer scale of the need. I mean, we visited a small displaced camp of 3,000 outside Mirka, and no NGO and no UN agency was present, and they were entirely dependent on handouts from the community, and food was clearly an issue. So it certainly plays into and reinforces the problems that Somalia faces, and also Mother Nature is certainly not cooperative. There's a drought in Somalia. Bad news always comes hand in hand. I remember that the tsunami also affected Somalia back then in 2004. So Somalia faces problems on many fronts. There's a very high percentage of the displaced that are moving into the food insecure areas in South Central. So displacement also causes further food needs. So just as on the last note, I think we all talked about the political process ongoing in the Horn. I think that especially the policy community represented here in Washington have a have a sort of duty to influence policy, and certainly U.S. policy, and that balance that Princeton was talking about between the global war on terror interest and the stability interest of the U.S., and how too often those are at odds, and the need to find that balance in Somalia.
Well, thank you. Let me just say a couple of things. First, on the diaspora, obviously it's a large and diverse group, but I think it could be more influential. I think that a lot of money is flowing into Somalia. Some of it's flowing into arms, some of it's flowing into factions. It would be good, I think, if elements at least of the diaspora organized to look at where the money is going and how the diaspora can play a bigger role in encouraging the peace process. And moving away from the, as Matt said, the precondition about Ethiopian withdrawal, that has to be done in a context of something else happening, a peace process happening. So I think the diaspora is strong and can play a big role, and it has played a role. Question is, what could it do more for peace? Second, I just say that the U.S., the biggest security involvement in Africa is in the Horn. We have a big military installation in Djibouti. We have this big involvement in Somalia, et cetera. And therefore, rethinking the security policy and the broad policy of the Horn, I think, is one of the biggest challenges to the new administration. Finally, just to reiterate things that Patrick has talked about and the lady back there, I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, talked about, but we do not focus enough on who's paying the price for all of this. And the people who are paying the price are the Somali people who don't have arms, who are driven out of their homes in the hundreds of thousands, perhaps. And that doesn't seem to be high enough on anyone's agenda to deal with. And that's the real tragedy of this, that in all these confusing political interests of outsiders and insiders, so many people are suffering. And maybe we need to bring that more to the fore as forceful influence on the policy of all these different actors. Thanks.